Today on Velcro Love, we have an expert on sex and relationships with us. Dr. Lori Watson, sex therapist and EFT therapist, is here to talk about sex and relationships. Stay tuned. I'm so excited.
Welcome to Velcro Love, a podcast about attachment theory, relationships, therapy, love, and sex. Our content is based on the groundbreaking work of Dr. Sue Johnson, the founder of Emotionally Focused Therapy. Your host is Ed Peterson, licensed psychotherapist and certified supervisor in Emotionally Focused Therapy. Our goal is to share the healing power of attachment theory and emotional regulation with as many people as possible and to have fun along the way.
I'd like to introduce Dr. Lori Watson. Lori has a doctorate in sexology. She's a PhD and a licensed marriage and family therapist. She's been a licensed marriage and family therapist for over three decades and is certified in emotionally focused therapy and AASECT sex therapy. She's the author of the book, Wanting Sex Again, How to Rediscover Desire and Heal a Sexless Marriage. And she's a sex blogger for WebMD and Psychology Today with over 40 million reads. And she's the owner, director, and supervisor for Awakenings Counseling and Counseling Near Me. That's Awakenings Counseling, which is at www.awakeningscenter.org, and Counseling Near Me, which is www.counselingnearme.us. She co-hosts the popular sex podcast, Foreplay, Couples and Sex Therapy, which can be found at www.foreplayrst.com with over 10 million downloads. So, Lori Watson, it's wonderful to have you. Thank you for joining my podcast.
Thank you. I'm so excited, Ed, about you doing this. I mean, there cannot be enough conversations about love and sex.
Dia, first of all, of why you do this, why are you so interested and have given your life to this topic of sexuality and relationships? And then we could start talking about, in general, this idea of what is a sexual cycle between couples?
Okay. So I started off as a young therapist, teaching a premarital class for a really big church. It was a wedding church, and they demanded that people go through my class in order to get married in the church. And I also had two couple sessions with each couple that came through it. Saw a lot of people, taught one section on sex, but noticed that all the young couples, when they came back, really focused on their sexual relationship and had sexual problems. And I was kind of surprised because I thought, wow, you know, newlyweds should be hot and heavy. But it turns out that sex is an easily dysregulated part of the partnership. And, you know, both of them work together. So people would get dysregulated emotionally, which would impact their sexual connection. And they would be disconnected sexually, which impacted their emotional connection. And I began to see this and I thought, wow, this is something that I think is important. I didn't really get it at that point, how important it was. I didn't have the theory behind me, but I realized it was, and sex was really important to me in my marriage. And so I thought, this is something I think I want to specialize in. And I specialized in sex therapy. That's ASECT. I eventually got certified. I actually went around to all the gynecologists and just told them I'm specializing in sex, and I didn't know a thing about sex. But
I would say that was a smart move.
Yeah, it was my heart. And I had had a few classes and thought I knew something, but I don't really think I did. But I got a lot of experience. And then I did get certified. And then eventually I went on for my PhD in sexology. But I started to practice sex therapy from an attachment lens. So I really did understand the pursue withdraw cycle. I didn't become as effective at resolving it as I did much, much later in my career. Just recently, I think EFT has exploded my understanding technique-wise about how to get through some blocks that used to always hang me up. I think for those of the EFT therapists who are listening, they'll understand what I'm saying. I used to always try to do pursuer softening first before I did withdrawer re-engagement. And even in the sexual cycle, you cannot do pursuer softening first. You have to re-engage the sexual withdrawer first in order to get movement. And
right.
So, yeah.
Well, yes. And here's one thing that I'll just reflect that you said that really just hit home for me when you said that you had a big experience and learned a lot from those newlywed couples, right? Mm-hmm. Who, in your words, you thought you would think would be hot and heavy and hitting on all cylinders with their sex life, right?
Yeah.
But then you also said that sex can be so dysregulating.
Yeah.
And maybe that would be a way to help our listeners here understand this idea of what does it mean how sex can be emotionally dysregulating? Because isn't sex supposed to be wonderful and hormones and all this great stuff? But especially maybe in the context of a newlywed, how is it that it can be dysregulating? And how does that sort of inform this idea of a sexual cycle?
Yeah, that's a great question, Ed. And there are so many ways that sex can get dysregulated. I mean, young couples come together, and many of my young couples had not been fully sexual, or they had not been sexual for long. They had had religious sort of faith-based decisions that they had made about not being sexual. So there was a lot of guilt if they had crossed lines that they had committed not to cross. There was a sense of, you know, God told us it would be wonderful. And suddenly they realized it wasn't wonderful because they didn't know anything about how to do it.
Right.
There was, you know, the typical kinds of ways that sex gets off, you know, maybe one person wanted a lot more sex and the other person didn't, or one person wanted different to do and try different things and the other person didn't want to try and do those different things. Some of it was, you know, maybe the female wasn't orgasmic and didn't know how to become orgasmic, or could be orgasmic through masturbation, but thought she should be orgasmic through sexual intercourse, and her partner thought so too, and they didn't really understand actual technique that made sex great for her. I mean, I did not see, so when I was teaching, early in those years, there was no internet porn. So that's how old I am.
Right.
I was teaching and leading this class before porn hit the internet. So there was people were using porn, but not nearly to the extent that it grew once it became anonymous and widely available. So that was not quite as big of a problem back then, but there was still plenty of problems.
Right. Well, and see, boy, you've said a lot of really important things. I just want to highlight a couple of them, which I really think is going to help anybody. I mean, it's helping me just to hear about it, because I'm thinking about what you said about how, you know, couples as newlyweds, but it could go throughout a marriage, which I see clinically in my office all the time, mm-hmm. that when the actual act of making love, you know, that act can be embarrassing. It can be clunky. It's, I always say that there's a lot that can go wrong. There's a lot that can go right. But if you throw in the fact that people can get embarrassed, that people could have shame, and that people may just, like you said, also not be prepared by their culture to actually revel in or enjoy their sexuality, but maybe have this rigid thought that it's supposed to be one way. Mm-hmm. Because I think we know that if our brains think that sex has to be one way, wouldn't you say that's kind of a setup?
Oh, it is such a setup. And I think that many of us have rigid ideas about how sex is supposed to be, you know, and there's so many beautiful ways that sex can enhance a relationship. It can be something that we use for intimacy and pleasure. That's the most secure way. Those are the secure motives that securely attached people use to make love, you know, and there is two other motives that are common. One is stress relief and the other is for approval. So some people, we understand stress relief, right? I want to go to sleep. I need an orgasm. I've had a bad day. I just need to get away from it all. And sex is a great way to do it. And that is totally fine in secure relationships. The anxiety motive, the approval motive is maybe I'm having sex to get you to like me. I'm having sex so that you'll want to have a relationship for me. I'm having sex because it proves my worth. I'm having sex because it proves my attractiveness. Not a terrible motive in and of itself. I think we all do that from time to time. But if that's a sole motive and it's sort of fraught with anxiety, frequently our partner doesn't feel connected to.
Right.
It's like, it's all about you. It's all about your needs. It's all about proving something. It's not about me. And same with the stress relief, a fine motive in a normal relationship every once in a while, or, you know, it's fine to want to have an orgasm before you go to sleep. But frequently, you know, people will say, but I don't really want to be your sleeping pill, you know, not every night or not frequently,
right,
because I want to feel like you want me.
Right.
And so sometimes these different motives can create a disconnect. You know, when sex becomes a frenetic need, I need to have it. I need to have it because otherwise I am unsure of your love for me. Then you're not really able to give love in that situation. And in sex, there's a give and a take, right? Most of the time we want our partner to react with joy, with, you know, a responsiveness. Like when we say, hey, 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 you know, we want our partner to go, hey, 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 back, you know, that's what we want.
Right.
We want to connect. Yes. We want that their eyes to light up. And we want them, we want to feel like they want us. But if one person is saying, you know, you don't want to have sex with me. What's wrong? I need to have sex because this is where I get my self-worth. And so I'm always, 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 you know, pushing for it. The other person can feel drowned. They stop being responsive. And they maybe shut down and say, again, you want to do it again? Oh, I don't have time. Or let's get it over with. All the things that people say to block that frenetic energy. Or the person who on the other side maybe is a sexual withdrawer and starts the cycle by saying, can we get it over with? I don't really like this. And why would they do that? Many times, you know, because sex is so fun. It's not like going to the dentist, right? Sex is a pleasurable event. But many times people who are sexual withdrawers, they do like sex, but maybe they don't know their own body. They don't really know how to take pleasure. Maybe they started in their sex life long ago, maybe even with other partners, with a motive for approval. And so they had sex to make people like them, but they never really shaped the sexual relationship in ways that were pleasurable for themselves. They never learned how to do that. They didn't learn how to speak up. They didn't know their own body.
Right.
And so the withdrawer can also start a negative cycle as well, just as easily, right? By rolling their eyes, by pulling back. And maybe they pull back because it's an interpersonal relationship. Maybe they pull back because it's an intrapsychic issue. I don't deserve pleasure. I'm ashamed. A lot of my couples were, I feel guilty because I, you know, went too far when I wasn't married yet. And now I'm going to punish myself by not enjoying this wonderful relationship. I don't feel I deserve it. You know, we can go on and on. I don't feel I'm attractive enough, so I don't want to get naked with you. You know, all of that.
Right, right.
So there's both people can start the cycle. The pusher, the pursuer, and the withdrawer can start a bad cycle. And that's kind of where we end up. Oftentimes, if couples don't have good sex. So you know what? We need good sex because it's really crucial to the strength of a couple's bond. And if they don't have good sex, if the sexual connection, and it's really not just sex, it's the sexual connection that needs to be strong. So that means we can say no to our partner when we don't feel like doing it. Having a good sexual connection is not necessarily having an equal sense of frequency as our partner, but we have to respond to our partner. And if not, if that connection is broken, then basically, you know, we wonder, am I in love with this person? Are they in love with me? You know, definitely we can be tempted toward infidelity. And we know that like 59% of all couples say that their divorce was because of sexual problems and infidelity. And we can just kind of, it can be flat. You know, life can erode. It's like, what's the fun? What's the excitement? Because sexual attachment is the behavioral cycle in a relationship that brings excitement. We think about the emotional attachment as bringing security. You know, you are my home. But in sexual attachment, that is where excitement lives. That's what enlivens the ordinary Thursday night. That is when we say, you know what, I'm going through the grind of the week, but darn it, I get to have sex tonight. And so my body is going to feel ecstatic. And that makes our life, you know, kind of worth living. It makes raising the kids, paying the bills, going to work every day. Mm-hmm. It's kind of worth it because we're coming home to our partner. We feel that sense of connection emotionally, and we have the joy and ecstasy of sex.
Right. Well, boy, I hope that our listeners really took in what you just said. And if I know for me, I'll probably listen to that again and again, because you said some really important things. And I'm going to give you one example from my life, Lori, okay, that I think will relate to exactly what you said. And you could maybe comment on this, right? I've been married to Candace for 22 years. Deeply love her. She deeply loves me. And in therapy once, we realized that one of our biggest bonds was that we both know at a very deep heart level that not only does she know me, but she knows my flaws and she's still crazy about me. Mm-hmm. And I'm the same way for her. But here was the challenge. There was something about our first 10 years of marriage where the sexual connection was so easy. It was, I think it had to do with hormones being a little bit younger. We're both in our mid to late 50s now. But there came this time that I noticed where suddenly the frequency was going down and we didn't really know why. But here's one example of what would happen. And this is what I learned actually from you and George on your podcast. And I had learned this before, was that here's the setup for us, right? It's 6 o'clock at night. Our three kids are at home. Candace has been running around, taking care of kids, seeing clients, having a career and being a mom. Mm. I'm exhausted coming home, having seen lots of clients. But I will drive into the driveway and yeah, I'll have some desire. I'm thinking, yeah, I'd like to get something going here. And I go up to her in the kitchen and I might sort of spring it on her. Hey, baby, how about it? And all it takes is a look from her, like, oh, kind of a sigh. Or if she's honest, she might just say, you know, right now I'm not there. And you see, Lori, I used to take that as she's not there at all for the whole evening. But what I learned was that just because she wasn't like ready and giving me, like you said, that her eyes weren't lighting up at 6 o'clock, she helped me learn, and you and George helped me learn, that that doesn't mean at 9:30 things couldn't be totally different. Does that make sense?
Nice. But the fact that the two of you could have something and then talk about it, having something different at 9:30, and that it was really a timing issue. She was telling you, my mind is too busy I haven't let go of my day. My day is still going. I want potentially to respond to you sexually, but I can't get free from all of the kids and work and all that kind of stuff. And I mean, that's actually a secure cycle, Ed. It's like, yeah, there's a bump in the road. Everybody has bumps in the road. But the two of you were able to talk about it, get through it. And she was able to communicate. It's, you know, when you're approaching me, it doesn't feel maybe attuned to where I'm at. And you were able to say, I get it. Your mind is too full right now. And so you want to be a good responder to me. You want to, your eyes do want to light up at me when I make that suggestion, but I need to learn when the moment is right too, for you. And it sounds like the two of you worked it out beautifully, and that becomes a responsive cycle again, right?
Well, yes. And the other piece of information is it took about 3 or 4 years to get there. And the pain and the suffering of the whole thing is for a long time, my reaction wasn't to really ask her what was going on. And her response was not to explain it to me. Mm-hmm. And so what would happen to me, Lori, is at 6 o'clock, I would make this move or a bid, which was not always, it's, looking back on it, I think it was kind of clunky because I didn't really understand how to flirt and kind of warm up to sex. But then you see, if I got that look, or if I got the what felt like a rejection, immediately anger would hit, immediately. And I only realized later that part of that anger was a deep fear that she really wasn't that attracted to me. Like I said before, my fear, honey, is that you like me and you love me and you're committed to me, but you don't light up for me, right? That there isn't that sort of animal attraction that sort of used to be there, right?
Right. There's and not we the, did work, the wow factor that the we're wow. looking for.
But we did work through it. But oh my God, for about 3 or 4 years, it was really hard. And I would get so angry that I would go get in the car and go drive away for an hour. And literally, I mean, I didn't even understand. It almost brought up rage for me. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does make sense to me, Ed. And I want to just organize what you said so that your listeners can hear all the things that I'm hearing you say. And I just want to begin with that if you had a sexual negative cycle that only lasted 3 or 4 years, you're doing great, because most right. people have negative sexual cycles that last for about 15 years. So right. trust me, 3 or 4 years, I'm sorry you went through that painful, painful time. And it is painful when we're caught in it, because sex is kind of a very primitive place that our hearts live. Our bodies and hearts live in this primitive place. Because it's beyond words. It's often beyond our intellect, but we feel it so deeply when we get rejected. And so what you're telling me is you looked at her, you came on to her in some way. Looking back, maybe it wasn't suave and sophisticated and seductive, like maybe now you've grown into, but she sent you that look and immediately you feel this, rage first, deep rejection. You know, what you would have to do is pull away. You'd even sometimes leave the home and drive away and protect yourself that way, of course, from this terrible feeling. And she's probably on the other side of it, right? I'm just going to imagine what she's going through as the look comes and she's like, uh-oh, you know, shark music, right? I'm in trouble. I am nowhere close to that. So I'm going to feel what? I'm going to feel like, oh, crap, I'm not enough. You know, why doesn't my body act like his body? Why can't I turn on just like that? He's going to be mad at me. This is not going to go well. So her heart sinks. Mm-hmm. You know, maybe she does send a little look like, you know, a frustration, maybe rolling her eyes or just pulling away. Or are you kidding me? Right. A little pushback. And then of course that lands in you so terribly, right? Because it's like, right. I put myself out there. I initiated. That's so risky, right? It's so risky to ask for sex. And I think that sometimes we don't see the sexual pursuer as really willing to take a deep risk And much of the time, our partnership needs romance. It needs sex. It needs the body involved. We are partnered in body and soul. So it's really important. And they're often the ones who risk. And I just want to say one more thing. I think, you know, between a man and a woman, we know the research tells us that most women are responsive sexual partners. So they need that impetus. They need that drive from a male to turn on. It is actually part and necessary. And I don't think that that is the pursue withdraw cycle. When there is an initiator and a responder, it's not pursue withdraw. It can be a very natural part of the way a man and a woman act together. The pursue withdraw cycle is, we consider it negative because anxiety enters both parties, right? One person is saying, I'm not enough. And the other person is saying, I'm too much for you. And so that anxious thought is what makes the pursue withdraw a negative cycle. But respond, initiate, or initiate, respond is not necessarily negative. It can be a very natural and very successful pattern in heterosexual relationships.
Right. Well, that's exactly it. And, you know, Lori, I think it's really beautiful the way you describe that, because you really did help organize that. And you see, I see the same thing with clients all the time. One of the things that I've noticed, this is a kind of a phrase that I've come up with, is that it seems like a lot of couples, especially who clearly love each other, but yet they struggle so much with their sex life, that it's almost like they get close to that moment where it's going to click. And it did click back maybe when they were courting or they were newlyweds. And they get to that moment where it's almost about to click. And then, exactly like you said, the anxiety kicks in, because it's like in a nanosecond, I can think, oh, shit, I may get rejected. Here it comes again. Mm-hmm. Oh, I'm too much. I'm not doing this right. I'm clearly not as good a, you know, seduction person as the people I see in TV. There's something wrong with me, because if only I was more attractive or more seductive, she would be responding to me. And then on her side, though, we've talked about this, I've seen so many, like you say, the sexual withdrawers, and that is the cycle for us, is that her anxiety is also around wanting to connect. And that's the part that I completely miss. When we're in the cycle, all that I see and experience is what looks like rejection, when actually her inside experience may be wanting desire, wanting closeness, but just not really being ready for it and not being able to communicate that. And so it's almost like we're giving each other messages, or no, I'm getting a message that she's really not wanting to give, but I believe it, right?
Mm-hmm. The message you're getting is, I'm not attractive enough for her. She doesn't desire me. And that, I think, for most of us, if we believe that we're not attractive to our partner, our heart just sinks. It's like, oh, crap. You know, I'm in this for life. You know, I've committed to fidelity, and now it feels like my partner isn't going to want me because they're not attracted to me. That is a very discouraging, depressing experience. And her too, you know, she actually, her motive was not wanting to have sex, and she wanted to connect. She wanted to feel close to you, but maybe for her, it was just always bad timing, you know, and you didn't figure it out. And I just love what you're saying, because I'm a sexual pursuer too. So I know those same sense of, I know the things that I tell myself, right? Which is, you know, I'm not attractive enough, not a good enough lover. Maybe I don't know how to seduce well enough. You know, every other woman, just all she has to do is bat her eyes and boom. You know, I mean, it's, I think that, and that goes into who we believe we are, right? The view of ourself, which doesn't lead to much confidence, you know, and confidence is sexy in bed. We all know that.
That's you know, right.
So yeah, it can be. I think that's the problem with a negative cycle, is it's a snake eating its tail, right? It really hurts. you know, over time, and it gets worse because of some of the meaning that we make out of it, that what we tell ourselves about our partner's reaction. And of course, on the other side, the withdrawer is saying, oh, you know, I'm not good enough. And I want to just say one thing about sexual withdrawers, Ed. My experience, I've worked with literally thousands of couples about sex. And many times the sexual withdrawer actually has a profoundly intense experience in sex. So their bodies can be wired in a way that actually feels very, very intense to them. And their hearts in the sexual moment feel so exquisitely vulnerable that it's almost like too much. I don't know. There's a popular theory out these days about highly sensitive people. Mm-hmm. You know, they don't like noises. They don't like textures. You know, too much intensity bothers them. And it's almost like sexual withdrawers are highly sensitive people about sex. It's not that it's too little, it's that it's too much for them to withstand. Their window of tolerance is, you know, just very, very short, because literally what we can't see in them is that their bodies experience it in a way that is just like so much for them. So they try to control that experience. They try to control the intensity of what they're going through. But of course, the partner feels like they're trying to control them.
Right.
But actually, they're trying to modulate this very intense experience. And I, you know, that to me is the joy of working in the sexual cycle so much, is it's so complex. I mean, then there's, you know, then there are sexual dysfunctions, let alone what we're talking about, which is mm-hmm. the sexual disconnections. You know, but there's sexual dysfunctions, and then there's body problems. And like you just kind of alluded to, there's different stages. There's early marriage, there's menopause, there's aging, there's tiredness through all the child rearing ages or the empire building stages, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So,
right.
I mean, yeah, I think it to me, it has enough variability that it always keeps me very interested in how to work with it.
Right. Well, yeah, see, and I'm taking from our conversation what you're saying, even though we both know that there are lots of ways that cycles can happen, negative cycles can happen, there are lots of reasons for that. I think there's also what you're talking about is a profound hope and a profound sense of that people can work through that. And maybe that as we're wrapping up, that we can let people know that, you know, that we've seen it. You've been doing this for 30 years. I've been a therapist for 20, and I've seen so many couples work through this and start having different conversations. And so even though there's a lot that could go wrong, I just want people to hear that, boy, there's so much hope for better connection. Wouldn't you agree?
I totally agree. I wrote my book, Wanting Sex Again, because most of the phone calls that came in, and at the time I worked more dominantly with women, but it was a woman calling saying, you know, I could care less if I ever have sex again. I really never want to have sex again. And when you first hear that as a flat statement, and can you imagine hearing that as a partner as a flat statement, it just feels like a brick wall. Oh my God, they never want to have sex. And we, I think, intuitively believe that sex is sort of only in the body. It's only about hormones. And so there's this just brick wall. Where are you going to go with that? Right? Because we certainly don't want to have people being forced to have sex that they don't want to have, or when they don't want to have it. That's not the answer. That's not the solution. And that's not going to be, that's not really even going to satisfy those of us who are longing, those partners who are longing for sex, because it doesn't come from our partner's heart. You know, so, you know, just if they, what I say, like lay down and think of England, that's not good enough. But I think that what I found is I slowed it down for myself, and I realized that statement meant many different things to many different people, and that desire had somehow or another been occluded. It had been blocked, because I really do believe, and Mike Moran, who is now a friend of mine, and I'm grateful for his friendship. He's another EFT, sex therapist, and a great guy. But, you know, he says that desire is chi. It's a life force. And so if it gets blocked, that's what we, you know, I think the beautiful thing of working in the sexual cycle is all we got to do is uncover the blocks, because we can depend on chi, you know, the life force to come forward. So yes, really what we're doing is looking for what stops this person. Is it in the cycle? Is, you know, their partner pressuring them because they're kind of frantic and they're withdrawing from that pressure, or they're withdrawing from that pressure, bringing on more pressure? You know, is it a cycle, and can we resolve that and start to get them to talk more directly and vulnerably? Or, you know, is it really kind of a technique problem that we can kind of help them with? You know, are they not having orgasms? Are they having orgasms too quickly and they feel ashamed of their performance? And, you know, all of those things we can actually work and solve with EFT and put it into the cycle and help people talk about it, you know, more easily. Or, you know, and I think that there's enough that that is, you know, other blocks, like maybe it is a life stage issue or a pain problem. And what I would encourage therapists out there who are listening to this is, don't be afraid to ask lots of questions. Ask what they do in bed, you know, make yourself safe enough and comfortable enough to have that conversation. And if you're a couple listening, I would so encourage you to learn to talk about things more easily with your partner. Find a common language, you know, sit down one day, you know, at coffee on a Saturday morning and say, okay, what are the words that really feel comfortable to you when we describe our body parts and our sex acts? And what do you like? This is what I like. You know, figure out where you are. If you're the pursuer, withdrawer, figure out if you really are in a cycle. Maybe ask your partner, so are you having orgasms, or are you not initiating because you're so afraid you'll disappoint me? You won't have and maintain an erection, or, you know, you're going to come too quickly, or, you know, is that what fell off? Is that why we are not having as much sex, because you're afraid of that? Like, really begin to talk directly, gently, because, you know, our sexual egos are huge and brittle. You know, yes, all we need is one comment from a partner. Hey, putting on a little weight there. Or, you know, gosh, you know, what's wrong with your penis? You know, why is it not working? And it's like, why don't you come? Every other woman came this way. You know, what's wrong with you? You know, all of that kind of stuff could just crush us. And so we have to be the most tactful. We have to have the most tactful conversation of our lives with as much gentle frankness that we can have, right? We can't just be brutally honest. Like, yeah, I'm not attracted to you. It's like, woof, okay, there's not much room left there. But like, yeah, maybe, you know, I, you know, find that, I don't know. Attraction, we got to do another podcast on that.
Yes,
one, because that's a big one. Okay.
Well, so thank you, Dr. Lori Watson. People, you can find her at the wonderful podcast Foreplay Radio with George Fowler. And Lori's written books and she's got websites. You can find her, therapist, Dr. Lori Watson. Lori, thank you so much for your time.
You are so welcome. Always good to be with you.